This is chapter 9 of Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smylie, and this chapter is entitled A Nonsuch for a Clerk. It is clear, writes Professor Rendell Harris of a 19th century saint, that we must begin our reminiscences by constructing for him what the Jews called a Sefer Toldoth, or Book of Generations. There is a peculiar appropriateness in so beginning any sketch of Archibald Johnston, Lord Warriston, the lawyer of the Covenant. He owed much to the men and women of his house who had travelled the high road of life before him. A bad heredity is a woeful burden, and they are much to be pitied against whom from the cradle fate and their fathers fight. But there is a good heredity which is a strong shelter to the soul and an incalculable aid to holy living. Archibald Johnston, like numbers more, had many reasons to be thankful for his Book of Generations. He could hardly have been anything else than a learned advocate. His father, Sir Thomas Craig, was a renowned pleader and the author of a treatise on feudal law. One aunt was wife of the first Lord Jury and mother of the second. Another aunt was married to Sir James Skene, president of the Court of Session. Merchant burgess of Edinburgh as his father was, the boy who was born in March 1611 to a career so stormy was predestined to a lawyer's ambitions and victories. A Sefer Toldoth prophesied his eminence in the courts. But if the God of parents is the God of children, there was as much likelihood that he would be a Covenanter and a Christian. He had a grandmother, Rachel Arnott, who was a princess in the aristocracy of the Kirk. She had hidden Robert Bruce within her walls. Robert Bruce, the minister of St. Giles, who was often at cross purposes with James VI. In the same house, too, in the Sienne's, when the five Articles of Perth were ratified by the Black Parliament, those Edinburgh preachers who objected to such episcopal lawmaking and whom the magistrates had commanded to leave the city spent an entire day in prayer. Archibald Johnston was 15 before white-haired Rachel Arnott died, and from her lips he must have heard many a history of heroism and godliness. This will be a lawyer, we predict, as familiar with heaven's bribeless hall and with Christ the King's attorney, as with the Court of Session and the General Assembly of the Church. Having taken his degree in Glasgow, he passed as an advocate in the winter of 1633 and settled in an Edinburgh home. Soon he married, finding his bride in a judge's daughter, and so forging a fresh and delightful chain to bind him closer to his profession. Helen Hay could have no disturbing presentiment in the joyousness of her wedding morning of that tragic hour. 27 years later, when she should beg the forgiveness of her husband from an obdurate king and should urge him in vain to pity her 12 children, reduced to a poor and desolate condition. At first all went prosperously, and the town house in the High Street and the country house of Warriston, 7 miles from the Mercat Cross, were palaces of content and hope. But indeed, let it be merry June or bleak-nighted December in his calendar, Lord Forresterseat's daughter had only a proud love to bestow on her husband. He was young when he thurled himself to the cause of the Covenant. We have seen him, still some years under 30, reading the great parchment to the crowd in the Greyfriars, and now, with tone distinct and clear as one whose word is power, Johnston of Warriston stood forth, God's gift in danger's hour. Think about the Christian Legal Centre today being the lawyers, among others in other organisations, but being lawyers who are standing up for the cause of Christ in the courts. But before 1638 he had been in conflict with Charles and Laud and had proved himself their superior in wit as well as in piety. For example, when the Scots were busy framing supplications and protestations against the tyrannous actings of Whitehall and Canterbury, who was more enthusiastic than he? They devised 4 permanent committees of their best and ablest men. Tables they called them, the first composed of the nobles, the second of representatives from the counties, the third of members of the presbyteries, the last of burghers and townsmen. Then out of these they constructed a central table made up of 4 deputies from each of the others, which sat constantly in Edinburgh and conducted all negotiations with the Privy Council. But this effective instrument of scrutiny and criticism, this popular and vigilant opposition, was really of Johnston's planning, and in the central table he was clerk and secretary. Canny Linkside lawyer, he might be. It is Thomas Carlyle's portrait. Thomas Carlyle was a famous commentator. I think he came one or two centuries later. But nevertheless, full of fire, of heavy energy and gloom, a very notable character, and ere long he will be a Lord Register of whom all the world has heard. The Glasgow Assembly set him more conspicuously than ever in the van of the church's fighters. He was the man who framed its enactments and put them into proper shape. For when on Friday the 23rd of November the ministers and elders proceeded to the election of a clerk, all of them, with one solitary exception, voted that no one else must be chosen. They understood what they were doing. The young advocate stumbled at once, we are told, when he had a singularly difficult paper to write. But that was at the very commencement. There was no subsequent failure nor semblance of it. When we paint a mental picture of the cathedral in those dark wintry days, and of its thronging and eager and sometimes noisy auditory, we must see that a little table is set in the midst, for an end to the commissioner. So long at least as it pleases His Grace to remain in such troublesome company, and behind the little table are sitting side by side Henderson and Warriston. Mr. Johnston to us all, Bailey says, was a nonsuch for a clerk. A nonsuch is a personal thing regarded as excellent. Charles was in choleric mood when he knew what was done in Glasgow. In the summer of 1639, one must think of the royalist soldiers with the king at their head embarked on the Bishop's War. They have assembled at the Berks near Berwick, whilst the Covenanters are encamped on Dun's Law. No pages in Robert Bailey's three volumes are more graphic than those which depict the scene. It would have done you good to have cast in your eyes a thought, our brave and rich hill, as oft I did, with great contentment and joy, for I, quoth the wren, was there among the rest. The regiments had noblemen for their officers, the captains were landed proprietors, the lieutenants experienced troopers, some of whom had stood ankle-deep in Lutzen's blood with the brave Gustavus. The colours, flying at each captain's tent, bore the Scottish arms, with the motto in letters of gold, for Christ's crown and covenant. There were some companies of Highlanders, supple fellows, with their plaids, targes, and dorlochs. But most of the soldiers were staunch young ploughmen, whose capacity increased with every hour. The good sermons and prayers, morning and evening, under the roof of heaven, to which their drums did call them for bells, the remonstrances very frequent of the goodness of their cause, of their conduct hitherto, by hand clearly divine, also Leslie, his skill and fortune, made them all so resolute for battle as could be wished. In Alexander Leslie they had indeed the best of commanders. Such was the wisdom and authority of that old little crooked soldier that all, with an incredible submission, gave themselves over to be guided by him as if he had been great Solomon. And in the tents Bailey heard the sound of some singing psalms, some praying and some reading scripture. Such battalions would have been unconquerable, as Charles did wisely when he concluded the pacification of Berwick and ceased for a while from the hostilities. It was Archibald Johnston who took the main part in bringing the king to terms. In his diary for 1 month of his life, from May the 21st to June the 25th, 1639, a precious fragment which the Scottish History Society has published, we see him at this wartime in his virile quality, his impetuosity and heat. He asks the Edinburgh Committee and the various counties for men and material and letters, which, like Cromwell's, are like the firing of some 200 shot. They are not worthy to be free men that will neglect their country, which is now ready to bleed for their neglect. Be not wanting to yourselves, and be confident God will send an outgate to all these difficulties. Shall our enemies be more forward for invasion against the truth and for our slavery, than we for our defence for the truth and for our liberty? In the end, they have neither Christian nor Scottish hearts who will expose their religion, their country, their neighbours and themselves to this present danger without taking part. These are clarion calls, but Warriston's devoutness is apparent and his patriotism. On Monday, June the 3rd, he spends the whole afternoon in conference with Alexander Henderson and David Dixon and Robert Meldrum, the Secretary of General Leslie. They have bethought, and better bethought, on the necessities of the army, the want of money and munition and order and discipline, the natural impossibility of retiring or of remaining or of going forward. They had been forfoughten with the consideration. But then the sun breaks through the clouds. Despairing of secondary causes and human helpers, they look up to heaven. David Dixon attests that when God delivers them, they who have been emptied and annihilated of all their wits and judgment shall admire and adore him alone for building so high an edifice on so low a foundation, for bringing so great an ebb to so great a tide, for drawing so rich an abundance out of so vast a want, and in despite of the devil and all our straits. Archibald Johnston goes from his council of war with a quiet heart. He has seen the aurora in the eastern sky, but how rapier-like and stinging his speech could be. It leaves goads in the minds of others, and sometimes pangs in his own. He bears the brunt of the negotiations with Charles, and His Majesty resents the pithiness of his utterance. Quote, "The king answered that the devil himself could not make a more uncharitable construction or give a more bitter expression. Again, the king commanded me silence and said he would speak to more reasonable men. And yet again, when we rose, he gave to every one of us a kiss of his hand, bidding me walk more circumspectly in time coming." There are no half measures in the covenanting lawyer's soul. The years went on. In 1641 he was knighted and became a Lord of Session. Later in the decade he was one of the 8 Scottish commissioners to the Westminster Assembly. The Jerusalem Chamber did not see so much of him as of Rutherford and Gillespie. But when he was present, he gave good help with the sharp point of his manifold arguments. Once, in March of 1646, he made a speech which was long remembered. The House of Commons had proposed to create a civil tribunal which should revise the verdicts of the church courts, and Archibald Johnston expressed the convictions of the majority in the Assembly when he said that there must be no headship over the spiritual realm bequeathed to Pope or King or Parliament. We must not edge away and hem of Christ's royal robe. His decisive sentences, except for their antique dialect, might have come from the lips of Thomas Chalmers during the 10 years' conflict of a later century. There are toilers who surprise us by the amount and the diligence of their labours, and this man was of their company. He was seldom able to sleep more than 3 hours out of the 24, such a restless mind he had, and such a perpetual anxiety to do a sheer darg for the commonweal. He could have appreciated both clauses in the advice given in a subsequent age by one of the most famous of his countrymen, "Fear God and work hard." And in the midst of his multiform tasks, he strove to keep the mirror of conscience unsullied. Greatly as he distrusted the policy of Charles I, he made generous efforts to save him from its consequences. But when the acts of the headsman ended the king's arrogances and ambiguities, Warriston was not of those who approved of treating with his son. He is clear from the stigma which clings in this connection to some saintly names. Probably this was why the second Charles had no shadow of compunction afterwards in sending him to his doom. Even to James Guthrie, the merry monarch could give a passing sigh when he was informed that all was over. But for Lord Warriston there were no repentances, however easy. There were only the hate of hate and the scorn of scorn. Charles had another cause for dislike. Johnston had accepted office and emolument from Cromwell. He was one of the 63 members of Oliver's House of Peers, and in 1657 he was reinstated by the Protector in the dignity of Lord Clerk Register of Scotland, a dignity which a few years before he had been compelled to forgo. These were sanctions of usurpation such as no other Covenanter had supplied, and the King might point to them in justification of his severity. Today, when Cromwell's moral grandeur is as patent to us as his military genius, we do not dream of blaming Archibald Johnston for what he did. His procedure, too, was almost pathetically necessary. He had lost all his means in promoting the great aims of his life. He had no income to provide for the boys and girls crowding the house in the High Street, and the salary of the Lord Clerk Register was sorely required. The lacrimae rerum, which the incident stirs, we discover elsewhere. In his own agony afterwards that he had made himself a trespasser, in his dying speech he bewailed his misdeed in moving words, "It doth not a little trouble me, and lies heavy on my spirit, and will bring me down with sorrow to the grave, that I suffered myself through the power of temptations, and the too much fear anent the straits that my numerous family might be brought into, to be carried unto so great a length of compliance with the late usurpers, which did much grieve the hearts of the godly, and did give no small occasion to the adversary to reproach and blaspheme. Scruple, says Jeremy Taylor, is a little stone in the foot. If you set it upon the ground, it hurts you. Lord Warriston's foot, we surmise, was fevered and vexed by a little stone. But it was his habit to scourge and afflict himself. Prince in Israel, although he was, his hasty temper was a poignant distress to him. Did it not mar his best pieces of work that he was subject to many excesses of heat, and thereby to some precipitations, which have offended standers-by and lookers-on? Perhaps, on occasion, his eloquence was a trifle vehement and exasperating, but his personal religion was of no slipshod kind. He was an ardent lover of the secret place. Kirkton says that he gave more time to prayer and reading and meditation than any man he ever knew. It was a common thing for him to be on his knees, alone in his room, for 3 consecutive hours. Again and again he lost consciousness of what was passing around him. Once, intending to spend the beginning of the day in fellowship with God, he continued his intercessions and studies from 6 in the morning till his own amazement the town bells rang at 8 in the evening. We comprehend now why his heart was garrisoned by peace. While the noise of the archers was seldom intermitted outside, he believed that he saw God face to face, and the night before his execution, he could tell a friend that not once, for a long period, had he known a doubt regarding his salvation. Those streams from the uplands fed the courage which never flagged, and nourished until the end of his wisdom and his stature. On the 14th of July, 1660, a warrant was issued for the apprehension of Sir James Stuart, Lord Provost of Edinburgh, Sir John Chiesley of Kurzwall, and Sir Archibald Johnston. The first two were arrested, but Warriston had some inkling of what was coming and escaped to the Continent. Enraged at missing him, his enemies proclaimed his offices vacant and his estates forfeit, but meanwhile his life was secure. In Hamburg, some months after leaving Scotland, he fell into serious illness. He was bled by a Dr. Bates, whose creed was not that of the Covenanters, and there were reports that the physician did not deal fairly with his patient. It is certain that he never recovered either his robustness of body or his clearness of memory. Probably got bled nearly to death. He was broken and old before his time. When he had been 2 years in Hamburg, he ventured to France to meet his wife, but the spies of Charles found him at Rouen. It is characteristic of him that, when they entered his lodging, he was kneeling in prayer from the audience chamber of God. They hastened him to imprisonment. In January 1663 he was confined within the Tower of London, where he lay for 6 months, and then in the summer he was transferred to the Tolbooth of Edinburgh. It was a feeble invalid who was led before the Scottish Parliament. There was no risk that the persecutors would be assailed by the indignation which once might have leaped from his tongue. Everybody compassionated him, everybody except the bishops and the Earl of Lauderdale, once his brother deputy at the Assembly of Divines. Lauderdale's malice, as we can read in his own letters. Thus, on the 23rd of June, he writes that there is, quote, a petition from that wretch's children, showing that he hath lost his memory and almost his sense, and praying for delay till he may be in a fitter condition to die. But the council, he adds, and his own was the most potent voice in the council, would not meddle in giving any respite. On the 2nd of July, after the prisoner's case has been discussed again, he describes divers voted for delay, but not his grace himself. I confess, though, I think I be as far from a cruel disposition as anybody, yet considering the justice of the sentence, and that if it had come to a delay, it must have brought the trouble of it to His Majesty, who only can grant pardon. I did clearly vote presently. Again on the 9th, very late, he has more news to send from Holyrood House. On the previous day, Warriston had been at the bar once more. Yet I must needs tell you something there was of compassion in the Parliament when they granted 14 days' time for the prisoner to prepare himself to die. And he received the sentence to be hanged and to have his head affixed with much more composedness of spirit than I did expect. He sate on his knees according to the custom, and then prayed God to bless the King, to bless the Parliament, to keep everyone from his condition, and again he prayed for the king, for the church, and for the kingdom, and without one word for himself he went out. So Lauderdale, who voted presently, was not balked of his wish. On the 22nd of July, Archibald Johnston was to finish his course and to receive his enduring crown. If the fire of his nature was less fervid, the faith was as firm. His young daughter had, at her request and his, been his companion in the Tower, and she remained with him in the Tolbooth, and always afterwards the prison was to her a gracious recollection. Her father's great concern was that he might, quote, not faint in the hour of trial. And the nearer the end approached, the completer became his tranquillity, until on the morning of his death he spoke with assurance, quote, of his being clothed in a long white robe. Before another night should descend on his Margaret and himself. Through all that forenoon she heard him praying, Abba Father, he would have understood and loved William Canton's verses. Thou hast seen how closely, Abba, when at rest, my child's head nestles to my breast, and how my arm her little form enfolds, lest in the darkness she should feel alone, and how she holds my two hands in her own, a little easeful sighing and restful turning round, and I too, on thy love relying, shall slumber sound. At 2 o'clock he was called from his cell, for the scaffold was waiting him at the Mercat Cross. Well he knew the spot. It was directly opposite the windows of his own house. They had made the gallows unusually high, to be in keeping with the offences which were to be expiated on it. Bound the place were the king's lifeguards on horseback, quote, with their carbines and naked swords, and there was also in guard of the tomb of Edinburgh with their colours displayed. On the way to the cross, Warriston often turned to the people and asked for their prayers. When he reached it, he read his dying testimony, first to those on the north and thereafter to those on the south, speaking in a distinct voice, the old voice of the Grey Friars given back again. Having finished, he prayed twice with the deepest contrition, but then in a kind of rapture, at the head of the ladder, he cried, I beseech you all, who are the people of God, not to scar at sufferings for the interests of Christ, for I assure you, in the name of the Lord, he will bear your charges. The moment after, he was heard to say, The Lord hath graciously comforted me. Then, asking the executioner if he was ready, he gave the signal, exclaiming, Oh, pray, pray, praise, praise. It was with arms uplifted to the summer skies, spectators remarked that Archibald Johnston, who had lived in familiarity with the better world, passed to see its glories. In Naphtali, that fine old covenanting book, his last speech may be read. There are the advocate's accent in it, and the patriot's accent, but best of all the Christian's accent, the discourse of the townsfolk in the city of God. He grieved that it was weak and short, for it had to be written in his dungeon. But it stands in no need of apology. These are its closing sentences. I do here now submit and commit my soul and body, wife and children and children's children, with all others, his friends and followers, all his doing and suffering, witnessing and sympathising ones, in the present and subsequent generations, unto the Lord's choice mercies, graces, favours, services, employments, empowerments, enjoyments, improvements, and inheritments, on earth and in heaven, in time and eternity, all which suits with all others which he hath at any time by his Spirit moved and assisted me to make and put up according to his will, I leave before and upon the Father's merciful bowels and the Son's mediating merits and the Holy Spirit's compassionate groans for now and evermore. Amen. Something there is in such language, a colour, a music, an intimacy beyond Greek and Roman fame.